I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Shakespeare's agent.
Shakespeare's agent. Shakespeare's earthly representative. That's how I think of you.
Stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here is Stage Door Johnny.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life. And life in the theatre. My name's Jonathan Cake, and my guest this week is a great man of the theatre and the lecture theatre. That's right. In my bid to embrace as many aspects of the theatrical experience as possible, I mean, I've had a newspaper critic, I've had musical composers. Oh, and next week, I'm going to tease right now, I have a great musician. My guest this week is a literary critic, he's an academic, he's a dramaturg. Dramaturg? Is that how you say it? To be honest, I've never quite known. I think it's dramaturg, not dramaturge. No, I think it must be dramaturg. A dramaturg, by the way, is someone who provides knowledge, insight, frames of reference for the text when an acting company is working on it in rehearsal. In-depth knowledge of the text is what a dramaturg imparts. He's a dramaturg to theatre companies like the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Public Theatre in New York. He's a kind of, as we discuss, a sort of theatrical midwife. He's a doula. In his formulation in our chat, he called himself a kind of head waiter in the director's fine dining choices. He's probably the greatest Shakespeare scholar alive. He is the brilliant James Shapiro. Now, Jim teaches at Columbia University, and if you've heard his name, it's probably as the author of a book called 1599, which was the Bailey Gifford Winner of Winners Prize winner for the best non-fiction book of the last 25 years. It was written in 2006, and it won every award going when it came out. It chronicles 1 year brilliantly in Shakespeare's life, when he wrote, get this, Henry V, As You Like It, still going, Julius Caesar, and Hamlet. That's right. In 1 year, he wrote those four imperishable masterpieces. Not a bad year for Bill. You can imagine he felt quite content at Christmas, and perhaps a little crampy in his quill hand. Jim's written many other great books. 1606, one of my favourites, about the slightly disappointing year when Shakespeare only wrote King Lear, Antony and Cleopatra, and Macbeth. He wrote a wonderful book called Shakespeare in a Divided America, and he teases us with his new one at the end of our chat. We met in late November last year, 2023, in a room in Jim's London hotel the night after the Booker Prize ceremony, for which he had been a judge. And if at first he sounds a bit pooped, it was quite early in the morning, and you would be after reading all those books. But we begin by talking about the performance he has to put on when he's giving one of his lectures, one of his celebrated lectures at Columbia University. Here he is. Here's James Shapiro.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your beginner's call. Mr. Cake and Mr. Shapiro to the stage, please. This is your beginners.
When you are lecturing from 10:10 to 11:25 about Coriolanus, you have done it for 30 years. You know the play. You know your talking points. Mm. You've weeded out the lines that don't work. Mm. And you know what they're going to say when you ask a question. But if you're working off book without notes, you have to have the lecture in your head. You have to have allowed just enough time for interplay before you move on. But that clock in the back of the room is going to say 11:25, papers are going to rustle, and you have to have finished the performance. So when you're on stage, you run over 2 minutes, under 2 minutes. It's never the same length of time. I clock every production I work with. You know, if you land within a five-minute window, that's great. And if there's a comic actor, it's going to run long once the director leaves. That's understood. But I can't. This is an audience that's going to get up and walk out at 11:25. So I'm working backwards from the clock, forward from the lecture. And if you've been doing it a long time, there's a confidence factor, but there's also, what happens if my brain stops working at 100% and I can't get the clocks forward and back in alignment? And I live in dread of that. A couple more years in the classroom and then I'll just lecture on occasion, so I won't have to worry about that. But
did you ever know an English don at Trinity College called Eric Griffiths?
I knew of him. Great writer. Okay. Brilliant writer.
Brilliant writer.
Is he a good teacher?
Extraordinary teacher. He would obviate the problem about the performance and where am I and what's by having a beaker, tall beaker of milk on his podium whenever he lectured. And it was fascinating because you'd see him rather like a sort of stand-up. I mean, he really was one of those extraordinary performers. You'd see him just reach over this. It was a Tupperware, so you could always see the milk in it. And it had this sort of extraordinarily textural dimension to it. And he would lean over and take these long, meditative sips on the milk. And the lecture would essentially be over when the milk was finished. It was very fascinating.
He would just sip his way to the end of the glass, and then it ended. Yeah. I like that.
And actually, he was a huge boozer, so now I'm wondering whether it wasn't a white Russian.
There was something in there,
It could have been a white Russian.
I could not do that. I started my career at Dartmouth, which was, both for the students and the faculty, heavy drinking. Mm-hmm. And I remember drinking heavily at the faculty club at lunch and trying to teach. And that was the first and last time. And I was 26 and I could hold my liquor, but that was a good lesson. Mm.
We'll get on to how the rehearsal room or the sort of public space of actors' interaction and the classroom that you're familiar with both, you know, how they may have changed culturally and whether loosening your stays with a few glasses over lunch is going to get you in trouble these days. But I want to start by saying, thank you so much, Jim, for doing this, because you came last night. You've been here to judge the Booker Award, and last night was the very fancy presentation ceremony. You've spent a year wading through, I don't know, how many novels?
163.
163 novels, which you have to reread, right, when you winnow down?
You get down to about 20 or so before the shortlist meeting.
Right.
You reread them because some you had read over Christmas.
Sure.
And here, well, months later, you're not fresh. You have the shortlist of 13, a baker's dozen. And before the longlist meeting where you winnow that down to 6, you really have to give a pressured rereading.
Shit.
One or more of these is over 500 pages. So it takes time.
Do you have to? It's part of the rubric?
You just must for two reasons. One, you have to be able to argue with your fellow judges, which means turn to page 153. Oh. Here's a counterexample.
Right, right, right.
Or this one beautifully illustrates something you wanted to beautifully illustrate.
Right.
And there were a couple of actors, actor-writers on the committee.
Robert Webb and my old mate, Adjoa Ando.
So they have better recall. So they perhaps can skim or remember from a previous reading. I don't take that chance. And then you're down to your Booker finalists, and you really have to do a pressured read before you go into that committee. Yesterday was the ceremony, Old Billingsgate, and it was lovely. But the day before, we had met in the late morning and were in a room except for a lunch break till 6 or 7 at night.
Hashing it out.
And that was the exhausting bit because you really have to be sharp.
Punches thrown?
No.
Arguments? Voices raised?
You know, maybe because we had a couple of actors in there, they create a fellowship. Everybody was happily partnered up, so it wasn't one of those actor-in right. type things. So, but it was extremely collegial. We could all settle down on a desert island together. We liked each other. We respected each other. Great range of national, ethnic, age, ethnicity differences, gender differences. One binary, you know, two men, two women. So it was a real mix that Gabby Wood put together. But it's difficult. There were probably 15 novels good enough to win.
Did you get your pick?
I would never answer
that
question.
Man of
but
honor.
I think that we all agreed the short list was magnificent.
Yeah.
And that was the problem, that we had chosen six extraordinary novels and then had to choose one. And that is not an easy thing to do.
So this is a theatre podcast, obviously. We don't care about novels. I mean, beyond the fact that we read them and love them. But it's not our purview in this podcast. But I was struck, Jim, by the fact that you've had this extraordinary immersion in the kind of cultural imagination through the novel of one specific year, which is a big stylistic choice of yours in your own work. You have taken years, specifically 1599, 1606, and you have examined them in extraordinary forensic detail. So suddenly you were having, via artifacts or news sources or, you know, the price of timber in Elizabethan England, but you were seeing a particular year in our lives through the novel. Did it feel sort of analogous to you in some way?
I think the closer analogy is the theater season because, and you've been involved in this for a very long time.
How dare you?
A company has to decide which plays to stage in the next 12 months and what's going to be your fall season, the holiday Christmas bit,
right.
What's going to follow that up in the spring. And you have to try to catch the wave of what's going on in the world. So a play like Hamilton, which I saw very early in the run at the Public Theater in New York, was like watching a play surf a 50-foot wave all the way to the shore. It caught the moment.
Did you know that when you first saw it at the Public?
You are sitting there laughing and crying in equal measure. Yeah. And if you've sat through enough bad plays and good plays, it's very rare that you are laughing and crying at the same time. So it's not even a cerebral reaction to it. You're having a visceral reaction and you say, he caught the moment. Now, if Hamilton came out today, it might have a 2-month run and then disappear. Had it come out 3 years earlier, a 2-month run and then disappear. It's still playing worldwide and will long after we are turned to ashes. But great works of literature, great works of theater, great films catch their moment. And great books too, that nonfiction books that I try to write. When I sit down to write a book like 1599, which took me 15 years to research, had I published it 5 years before I did or 5 years after, it would have been remaindered 6 months after its publication. But for reasons that I could not quite anticipate or control, do anything else but feel, it spoke to the moment. And that is, you know, what every artist chases, but is really hard to get right.
Did you find a shared concern, or was there something underlying that came through these 163 novels, something shared, something of the moment that you could identify?
That's a good question. You're going to get books written in 2020 to 2022, a lot of COVID books. So there are people who try too hard to be relevant and speak to the moment. And most of those, however excellent, were past sell-by date. You can spill that milk out. It's no longer speaking as powerfully as it did to the writer in the moment of conception. And I know that during COVID, I sat down to write a book, Shakespeare and Plague.
Mm.
And I spent 6 months, as we all were, in isolation, feeling very happy with myself that I was feeling walking out on the street, two blocks from my home, passing the ice cooler truck stacked with bodies outside of the nearby hospital. So I was feeling a connection to Shakespeare walking through the streets of London in 1592-3-4. But after about 4 or 5 months, I realized a couple of things. One, it's horrible writing about plague. And two, by the time this book came out, no one would be interested right. in returning to right. what we were all experiencing not long ago.
Right.
And I gave the research away to somebody working in the field and turned to a completely different topic and didn't think it was time poorly spent. Mm. You just have to know if you're a writer or any kind of artist in the theater, playwright, actors deciding to take a role or not. Nothing could be worse than taking a role, signing up for a role. 6 months later, you enter the rehearsal room and you find yourself in a play that has missed its moment.
Mm.
And then you have to commit to a 14-week run. And you're watching other plays that you were subsequently asked or previously asked to sign on for. And you had chosen the wrong one.
Mm.
So
what about the timelessness, though, Jim, of great art? I have a friend, for example, Jez Butterworth, who, you know, great, great playwright.
Phenomenal.
And he is militantly, I hope you won't mind me saying this, but I think it's true, fair to say, he's militantly anti the current moment. Meaning, he thinks the job of an artist is to raise your eyes to a horizon and beyond. It's not about what's in your grill right now. He thinks, actually, art shouldn't be seduced by the moment.
There's being seduced by what is on the front page, and there's being seduced by the currents roiling beneath the surface.
Mm.
And when I say a work that speaks to the time, it's something that speaks not to headlines, but to what journalists right. and pundits don't see or feel.
Yeah.
And I would agree with him in the abstract. The problem now is we're inundated with books, films, movies, podcasts, streaming, so much so that there's every chance that one of those 161 books that or 155 books that didn't make the shortlist may have been a work of genius.
Mm.
But once the steamroller of time and judging passes on, rolls by, it's very hard for that work to belatedly get the recognition and acknowledgement of its greatness.
Mm.
So I am sure that there are many great plays, many great small films, many great novels and works of nonfiction that gain a few avid readers who recognize their timelessness, but they don't emerge into the popular domain.
They're not riding that wave, that 50-foot wave, the Hamilton wave. That extraordinary Hamilton wave.
I think about this stuff all the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? It really is that there is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken to the flood, leads on to fortune. That line from Julius Caesar of Cassius is so
true.
Yeah, and so interesting.
And Cassius, unfortunately, gets it right and wrong.
Oh, yeah?
Well, he gets it right. There was that moment, but he misunderstood what was driving that moment.
Right.
He understood the timing.
Right.
He misread the people.
Sure, Sure, sure.
Which is dangerous.
And there's that great Peter Brook quote that the great plays are like planets. They orbit closer to us at times,
that's
depending
wonderful.
On their preoccupation.
I've never heard that. That's brilliant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it really is true. I went to, and I know you've experienced this extraordinary intensity, speaking about Julius Caesar, when you consulted, when you were working on Oscar Eustace's production of Julius Caesar, of course, at the Delacorte. Which year was it? Do you remember?
2017.
Yes, of course, because it was the year after Trump's election. And Oscar's idea was to have a Trump-evoking look for the actor playing Julius Caesar, who gets assassinated. Long red tie, big blonde quiffy wig. Did he do the voice?
He didn't have to. He did the mannerisms.
Got it.
Calpurnia was Melania. And there was a moment on the tarmac in, I think it was in Tel Aviv airport, where she had smacked away Trump's hand. So there's a moment in Julius Caesar where the Trump-like Caesar is trying to grab her ass, and she just swats away his hand. And it was an electric current passed through the audience at that moment. And that was all it took to anchor the identification of those two.
So then Oscar did something very interesting, didn't he? Did he not plant something like 50 supernumeraries in the 2,000-seat Delacorte Theatre in Central Park in New York? Take it from here, because
sure.
I never saw it.
I saw it probably 15, 18 times with increasing anxiety as it became controversial. When you're artistic director, you get to spend how you like. So Modern Dress Production, planting 48 or 50 extras or supernumeraries, call it what you will, throughout the audience. So at the moment when Caesar is killed and Brutus and the others stoop and wash their hands, in clumps of two or three, they start standing up and heckling Brutus. And the reason Oscar did this was, one, the Upper West Side audience is overwhelmingly anti-Trump.
Liberal, sure.
Liberal, progressive audience. And he wanted us to have a head-snapping moment in which we realized that, yes, we don't like Trump, but to preserve democracy through undemocratic means is a disaster.
Mm.
That was the argument of his piece. What he didn't anticipate was a right-wing journalist would go to see it, speak to her bosses at a right-wing media outlet, and within 48 hours, it was all over Fox News and other right-wing sources and agitators were offering $1,000 to anybody who would disrupt the production. So I was at the first disruption where a member of the audience, you know the Delacorte well, rushed onto stage. You can reach the stage from any seat in the house in about 3 or 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. So you can't be stopped by security. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching, I forgot who it was, one of the women in the cast confront the intruder to protect the other members of the cast. And it was a scary moment. And what soon started happening was you had real right-wing protesters, and then you had faux protesters. And the old folk in particular in the audience were getting extremely nervous about
who was who.
New York City police are tackling people.
Actors in the crowd.
I mean, who's real and who's not?
Yes.
And at one point, I think a week before the end, watching yet another right winger tackled as he made it onto the stage. And at this point, this FBI, there's New York City police, this Secret Service. I mean, there's a lot of people involved in security. And I knew some of them. I couldn't take the pressure. I wasn't enjoying the performance. Mm. And I got up to walk out. And listeners don't know it, but I kind of look like your typical Trump supporter, a white guy of a certain age. And as I'm walking towards the exit, which is towards the stage, security is moving towards me rapid clip to hogtie me and carry me out. And luckily, one of them knew me and identified me, so I was allowed to go on my way. But that's as thrilling and scary as theater gets. And I have to say, what I didn't know, and I wrote about this in a book called Shakespeare in a Divided America, what I didn't realize in 2017, in the summer of 2017, was that this was a dress rehearsal for January 6th and the attack on the Capitol. Same folks, same values, same kind of devotion to Trump. I thought I was watching a play in the middle of the run rather than a dress rehearsal.
Amazing. So I have two questions from a theatrical point of view about that experience. I know it was deeply, deeply scary for the people. I know people who were in that cast. Death threats were coming through. You know, it was a really...
One paintball could have taken out an eye and ended a career.
Sure, absolutely. Or, you know, God knows... worse. It was an incredibly volatile time and remains so, of course, and still remains so. I mean, Jesus, as we look forward to 2024. But two questions about that. One, do you think from a theatrical point of view, if Oscar hadn't had this directorial flourish of making that whiplash moment by planting these people in the crowd, would it have lit the touch paper in the same way, do you think?
I do. Once you have a man with a long red tie, a blue suit, a big gut, and a wife who sounds like Melania, it would have been inevitable.
Right.
Because those made uncomfortable by this, especially when a group of actors who are mostly Black and Latinx actors assassinate Trump. There's two triggers. Deeper racial divisions in theatergoers, but they didn't understand how theater works. It's not real.
Right. I'm fascinated by this, and I totally take your point that it would have happened anyway. But Oscar brilliantly opened the door to a kind of engagement by making a fake version of Breaking the Fourth Wall. And I'm fascinated to know what the actors on stage did, the conspirators on stage did, when the paid extras were all shouting in protest. How did they play that moment of Breaking the Fourth
Wall? Were kind of shocked and silenced by that. That was their intention.
Okay, and then the play carried on?
And the play kind of carried on. It was unsettling.
Yeah.
And because I knew and I sat in the same seat every night, I got to know my faux protesters and when they would pop up. And I remember turning to... a white-haired woman sitting next to me, and I said, you know, don't worry, they're fake protesters. She was so, so anxious. I didn't want a medical emergency on top of everything else. But it has to do really with understanding what theater is and how it works. And if you don't, and there are always these stories from the 17th and 18th centuries about there was a production of Othello in Virginia in the mid-18th century in which the colonists trying to strike a deal with local Native Americans brought them into the theater. And in the middle of a violent scene in Othello, the so-called queen of this Indian tribe, as if they were queens, had her cohort, her entourage, stop the violence on stage. So there's always that question of, or reputedly so, of how real a production feels.
Yeah.
And maybe his mistake was making it feel that real. The assassination scene was choreographed beautifully. Mm. And if you didn't know better, that was not fake blood.
Amazing. My second question about it is, you, as a person who's dedicated your professional life to animating these plays, to celebrating these plays on stage, you know, your job is primarily as a scholar, but when you work with actors in performance and productions in performance, it is about realizing that these texts are three-dimensional things and they are meant to be performed. So that's been, you know, something that you kind of almost uniquely contribute, cross over from the world of scholarship into performance. And in that Peter Brook way of the great plays orbiting closer to us, that one was really coming at us like an asteroid in Oscar's production 2017. Was a part of you, as a great Shakespearean, thrilled by the effect it was having, meaning that it was not a dusty 400-year-old museum piece? This was potentially...
You gave a glorious Coriolanus. The only thing missing from that Coriolanus was rioting.
Yeah, right.
You go back to the 19th century, Germany, France, productions of Coriolanus have led to violence.
Sure.
So I suppose I draw a line, not a very clear line. I don't advocate any art that advocates violence.
Right, right, right.
Where anybody gets hurt.
Sure.
And luckily in this case, we made it to the end of the run with a lot of security.
Sure.
There were death threats to Oscar's wife and child and worse. But that having been said, if it can come close to that line, to me, it is thrilling. Not because, like a heroin addict, I need more of a fix each time, but because it confirms for me that theater still has the ability to shock and change people in ways that solitary reading of a play, which some people love to do, never achieves. It's a collective, communal experience that riles people. And that's, you know, that's a fix.
You had a magnificent quote. I hate quoting back people's utterances in case they disavow them, but I'm afraid this one could serve as the sort of strap line to this podcast. You said, or maybe wrote, but I think you said it, you said, the truth is that I prefer a bad staged version to a great one on film, or even a filmed version of a stage production. There have been several of these during the pandemic, several of these released during the current epidemic with theaters so often closed. But despite their excellent production values and often terrific acting, they don't hold my interest. It has to be live.
We stopped going to, most of us, church, synagogue, mosque, a generation or so ago. I don't know what the numbers are in Europe, but they steadily decline. And there are not many, if you will, secular church spaces left. Theater, for me, is that space. We meet and we commune. And there's something that happens when the lights go down and you feel a wave of laughter. You feel an electrical jolt that runs through people as if a bolt of lightning had struck 2,000 people. That is, and has always been for me. I mean, I never studied Shakespeare formally at school. I never took a Shakespeare class as a university. My education was going to London from New York, thanks to Freddie Laker's cheap flights, living here for a month every summer after quitting some really tedious job, and seeing 25 or 30 plays in as many days. And all Shakespeare except maybe an occasional stopper. And I was young, which is really important in theater going. You have to start young. And I was impressionable. I didn't know these plays. I didn't know how they were going to end. I wasn't like one of those Olympic diving judges with a little signboard, 9-5, 9-3, the splash at the end of Lear didn't quite work. I was just left crying at comedies and just wretched after tragedies. So that was my education in theater, and that still shapes the fix. I tell people that it was a drug and no less habit-forming, but probably less dangerous.
I'm fascinated by your origin story. You had a terrible experience, tell me if I'm saying this wrong, with studying Romeo and Juliet at high school?
Yes, junior high, 14-ish.
And you were totally put off it. Didn't love it. Didn't even get the rude bits.
Exactly.
Everybody else was chortling out and hated it. And then this extraordinary thing happened. You went with your brother on a backpacking trip. Freddie Laker's cheap 99 quid flights, New York to London. And you would see, and you would do this year after year, 30 plays in 30 days, most of them Shakespeare. But I do think there's something missing from this. And the thing that's missing, I'm wondering, is how a sort of Shakespeare apostate started seeking that shit out. Why him? You said you saw some stop up, but why not going to see Run for Your Wife? Why not going to see some musicals? What was it about those when you had so hated it? Did you feel like you were missing something, or was there something that got under your skin immediately about it?
I was not an intellectual. It wasn't as if I was trying to go home and impress somebody on a date. That, you know, I'd just seen 13 Shakespeare plays that week, which I probably had. It was The Fix. And the other plays did not give me The Fix. First year I went with my brother. He had acted. He was in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead the previous summer. I'd never acted, and except for one day last month, or last 2 weeks ago, I should say, had one day of acting experience, which is enough for a lifetime.
I want to hear much more about that. Keep going
my
with this.
My brother knew theater, and he liked comedy.
Older, younger?
2 years older. He liked comedies. He liked revues. He liked tragedies, too. But it was just the mix. And I think he and I spent that summer, and then I went back simply to see plays. That's all I wanted to do, to the extent of hitchhiking up to Edinburgh to see plays at the festival.
But the fact that it was Shakespeare got its hooks into you so early.
It sounds facetious, but for those who have taken drugs and are listening, there's a different high you get from pot or cocaine and or fentanyl, for that matter.
Well, this has always been my thing.
It hit me with the force of the most powerful jolts. So those productions are all tattooed inside my skull. I have recall of every show, and it helps me in rehearsal rooms when a director will say to me, you know, how do you do the ghost scene? And I said, well, Jonathan Pryce did it like this in the early 80s at the Royal Court, and this is exactly how it was blocked, what he was wearing. The audience levitated at this moment in shock. So I am back there at that moment. How many experiences in life can one recall? Yeah. We spend most of our lives trying to repress memories of bad dates or bad examinations or bad jobs, but this is something that we can recall with pleasure.
Yeah. These live experiences we recall, don't we? William Defoe said something very similar on this. He said, I can remember moments in the theater as though they happened to me just now. And there is something, isn't there, about, what is it, about the liveness that engages a different part of our brain. You know, a bit like reading a novel, we have to go out towards it. We have to be active participants in it. We are active participants in it. We are witnesses to a common humanity being played out on stage.
I never thought about this. I know nothing about neuroscience, so can't really tell why we remember certain things from our past or our childhood, or whether it's trauma-related or anything else, or what we suppress. But the fact that these scenes, these moments, these productions, I said tattooed in my skull, but the truth is they're parked in my brain, and they take up a great deal of space there. So were I a scientist, I'd try to understand why they live there and are so easy to activate and so pleasurable to activate. I can't think more about it than that, other than to say, when I am old and I hope not too senile, I may forget where I put the toothpaste, but I will not forget Jonathan Pryce doing the ghost of Hamlet.
Let's talk about the drugs. Tell me about that. Richard Eyre's production of the Royal Court. Jonathan Pryce, you just said, is the prince. And Harriet Walter?
Yes.
As Ophelia?
She was, and I've spoken with her about that. The great move was to have Jonathan Pryce both play Hamlet and the ghost of Hamlet. And it was a kind of Dybbuk, like his father lived inside of him. Mm-hmm. So rather than have the ghost come on dragging a 20-pound sword noisily across the stage in armor, all of a sudden, a voice emerged from inside Jonathan Pryce, unwittingly.
Like he was vomiting it up.
He was vomiting it up. That was what he did. Wow. And we felt for him. We didn't have cell phones and couldn't call medical services to get help quickly for him. And it's very curious that there are things that work in theater and things that don't work in theater. 30 years later, maybe 35 years later, I saw Jonathan Pryce play King Lear at the Almeida, and he hadn't lost any of his power. But there was one moment that a director should have explored in rehearsal and then banished from production. I was talking about it with my students last week, in which Jonathan Pryce's Lear touches Goneril in such a way as everyone in the audience knew this was a story of a father who had abused his child.
Right.
And the audience turned on Jonathan Pryce at that moment. You can imagine people calling social services to have him arrested at that curtain. Theater is so powerful that the slightest touch can flip a switch.
You fall off a mountain.
And change identification into resentment and anger.
So you've worked on countless productions of Hamlet since then, since that really formative one. You were working on one last summer, I think, Atto Blanks and Woods, again in Central Park for the public, directed by Kenny Leon. I mean, how, in your role as, what do you call yourself?
Shakespeare's agent.
Shakespeare's agent. Shakespeare's earthly representative. That's how I think of you, Jim. In your role as, you know, deep consultant on these things, sort of amanuensis, midwife, whatever sort of extraordinary kind of doula, Shakespeare doula you are of the text, how is it possible to push, you know, there's this great idea about the ghost, about how to do the ghost. If you're having trouble with how to do the ghost, you know, you have this reference point. You must have 1,000 reference points that just fucking worked. How is it when a director doesn't do that, is in the weeds, finding it difficult, how do you not go to your Rolodex and go, look, there's a way to solve this? Or do you?
Well, I feel a little bit like a waiter at a not-so-great restaurant sometimes. And this is the menu, and this is your choice. And sometimes somebody will say at the diner, I'll have the lobster. And, you know, I'll say, you really don't want the lobster. The beauty of it is I live in 1599. I'm now no longer the 18-year-old with his nerve endings open to the culture. I am older. I am established. I'm comfortable. I know where I'm going to put my head on a pillow every night, and I draw a steady salary, which means I cannot feel these plays as powerfully as the people I teach them to or work with. So when I go into the room with Atto playing Hamlet and Kenny
forgive me for interrupting you, but do you really feel that age takes away the ability to feel them in a particular way?
I don't think it's age so much as
comfort.
Comfort and being shielded from the terrors of the world.
How fascinating.
So once that happens, once you don't feel the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of disprized love, having been happily married for, you know, 3 decades, you can't feel what Hamlet is feeling any longer with the intensity that needs to be felt to give direction. So I'm not in the kitchen cooking this stuff up. I am saying these are the choices on the menu, and this is what you might not want to order, and this is what you will be feeling 8 hours after ordering that lobster. And I do not go into a production, and this is the only reason why I'm allowed back ever into a room. One, they know I can't act. Yeah. Two, they know I don't direct and couldn't direct. But three, I am there simply to listen very carefully to what a director's vision is. Yeah. And if the director says, help me with a cut, we work on the cut. If he says to me, do you think doing this will work? I will tell him it's worked these number of times. When I mentioned to Kenny Leon what Jonathan Pryce had done, his reaction was, man, that's good, but it's been done, so I can't do that. And yet he did a little piece of it. Because this was a production, largely black actors, Black Hamlet, in which ancestors mattered in a way that they don't to white audiences like me. So ancestors are more comforting than threatening. and speak to you in a helpful way.
Mm.
So at one point, Atu does channel his father, and it works in a way that on paper resembles what Jonathan Pryce had done decades ago, but the cultural difference meant it landed in a radically different way.
Mm.
So I'm not there to presume to know where the culture is right now, but I try to enable a director who lives in the world and feels that world to access what's in the text to realize that vision.
I can attest, your delicacy and your strength in the rehearsal room is an unbelievable resource. I don't really know how you do it. There's a sort of incredibly facilitating invisibility, but that's never because I feel like you're holding your tongue or you're not saying what you really think. It's a real magic trick you pull off.
It's not. It's desperation. I know Coriolanus, and I'm waiting for the hit. I'm waiting for the buzz.
I remember you saying that.
So I know you and Dan, who's directing it, and others in the cast are working towards that, providing that. And if I can help by suggesting something small, I just want my fix at the end of the day. And I want to come back and watch you recite those glorious lines and feel the thrill. And, maybe if it happens a quarter of the time in a production that I work on, that's great.
Right.
And maybe there are only a half dozen moments in a show where I feel that electrical current coursing through me. But I want these plays to speak to me afresh.
Mm.
And the only way that can happen is fresh bunch of actors, different cultural moment, maybe sometimes a different language, different director. And then, boom, the same words.
Blindside you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You said, I'm very conscious, by the way, of time because you've got to go and get a plane. 11:14.
We're good.
A few minutes. All right.
Oh, absolutely.
Listen, you said you can't act, which I have to take on trust. I doubt that. Tell me, by the way, you just did some.
I did. And I did one day of shooting. And I didn't really understand. I thought it was just going to be somebody with a shoulder cam and half an hour of my time. And I show up at a house in Brooklyn, which has been transformed into a set. And the crew, mostly from Breaking Bad, the wonderful TV series. Mm. I had cleaned my clothes and folded them nicely. And all of a sudden, a team of people said, we have to steam those quickly. And somebody's dusting my face. And all the stuff that you don't even think about anymore was an assault. And luckily for me, I'd been given a script.
Were you playing yourself?
Well, that's the thing. I'd done 4 hours of BBC Four documentary, the Shama type stuff.
Right.
And I was terrible. When I had to read even something I had written verbatim, as you have to do constantly, it felt like a hostage script. You know, send the money or they will kill me now.
Proof of life.
It was just proof of life. And that's how I sound terrified in those documentaries. And so I looked at the script and I was playing myself. In one of the scenes, introduce yourself.
Right.
I'm James Shapiro. I'm a professor of English at Columbia.
Right.
And maybe a decade ago, an incredibly talented novelist named Arthur Phillips had written a play. I never knew him. I knew he wrote a great novel called Prague. That was about it. Didn't read his other ones at that point. And he came to me to my office at Columbia and he said, you don't know me, but I was told you're the person to speak to. I'm writing a play, a novel rather, about a guy whose father's a con man who leaves him in a safety deposit box, an early printed quarto of a lost Shakespeare play called The Tragedy of Arthur. And part of the novel is telling the story, but at the end of it, as an appendix, I'm going to write a Shakespearean play called The Tragedy of Arthur. And it's a brilliant novel, and he is now filming, I guess, the 20-minute taster for the studios that are interested. They just want to see it.
Right.
So I can't probably in good faith name the actors, superstar actors who are all making cameos in this.
Interesting.
I'm the only, let's just say, rank amateur in this, but I have to play myself. And the first scene they have me do is teach two lines or a page from the tragedy of Arthur to eight students. I hadn't prepared, but I said, just give me a page from the play. And I saw two lines, and I knew I could get 10 minutes of solid lecturing out of that. And two of the eight students, a lot of my students at Columbia are actors. So right. Two of them were in the room, two of my own students. So the director has no idea what's going on. There are about 30 people watching this. And I turned to one of the students and said, 2 weeks ago, what did we read in class? And she said, Titus Andronicus. How is this line like that line? And they're thinking, how is this happening?
This is great improv.
You know, they say cut, you know, one take Tony, they called me. And what I thought as soon as they said that was, I'm done. What you must know, and nobody tells me, is, okay, we're going to do it 13 more times because a student's yeah. computer was tilted at the wrong angle, or we had to move camera two to this side to film it again and again and again. And by about the fifth take, I thought at the beginning of it, as they're saying, ready, go, that my mind was drained. And my IQ was now in the low double digits. And I thought, I'm really going to humiliate myself, do a kind of Jackie Gleason, yahama, hama, hama. I can't do this again. And it was terrifying. And I was only playing myself. And I knew that no actor could play me better than I could play a parody of myself.
You look very like him. You could do the voice. That sounds fantastic. And it's not easy playing yourself. I did a episode of a TV show that Ricky Gervais did called Extras with Ian McKellen, brilliantly playing himself. But Ian McKellen didn't understand that he was supposed to be playing an absurd parody of himself. He said, you know, they've called me Sir Ian McKellen. And
you're going to tell me the difference?
And he said, I would never refer to myself as Sir Ian. You know, we're all toilers in the same vineyard. Okay, so you just did some acting. It's fantastic. But you said, I can't direct. And it strikes me as a no-brainer that you have all this knowledge. You have all this passion. You've seen a million performances. Why wouldn't you be able to
I'll
direct?
I'll tell you why.
Tell me.
For all the reasons that you don't get because they're hardwired into you. And by the way, Ian McKellen can play both Ian McKellen and a role at the same time that he's playing a parody of Ian McKellen.
It was incredible.
And
the episode.
Until this moment, my only acting experience was back in 1977 when Ian McKellen brought a one-way Shakespeare production show to New York. And at the end of the one-man show, he invited anybody from the audience onto that Broadway stage who wanted to be in that scene, told us all to lie down and play the French Dead, and he did a great speech from Henry V at that moment. So I could always tell my student I acted on a Broadway stage in Shakespeare with Ian McKellen without getting into the weeds of the details. But the reason why I can't direct is simple. You know, as an actor, how important your body's movement in space is. You know, as an actor, how important the visuals are to theater, even when there are only a few, a prop or an entrance through a curtain. I am visually impaired, not in terms of being able to drive a car, but in terms of being able to see the relationships of objects moving in space.
Really?
So when I watch production, I'm just amazed when an actor enters from a different angle. Oh, my God, it changes everything. How did they, and why are they always working on diagonals? I don't get it.
Just do it with the choreographer.
Well,
fine.
You know, it's a foreign language I can never learn.
It is a different language.
And you have to feel it. You have to know as an actor if they're letting you block it yourself.
Yeah.
I can't enter from that side.
Yeah.
And it's not just being willful. It's understanding. Where actors are always saying, well, I exited that way, so I have to come back from that way.
Right.
The thought would never have occurred to me. So that's why a production by Jim Shapiro would be one of the worst.
Static, quite still.
That's kind.
Just go and sit down in a chair and we'll watch. Yeah. All right, let's get quickly back to the drugs before we wrap up. The drugs really fascinate me. The uncut fentanyl of Shakespeare in your life, do you think it has, it's obviously given you this extraordinary life and it sort of remains this crazy passion and crazy need for you. But do you think it's slightly ruined it too?
No, absolutely not. I'll tell you why.
The reason I ask the question is I sometimes think it's ruined mine, and only because nothing else to me, and I'm not just talking about plays, I'm not just talking about movies, I'm not just talking about novels, I'm also talking about life sometimes. Nothing else feels as red meat, as full a meal, as satisfyingly profound an experience. Everything else feels a bit pallid by comparison.
I'm fortunate that I have two dealers in my life, so to speak. One is the fix I get from writing books. So that's a day-to-day low dose. Today I'm going to research X. Mm. Today I'm going to discover something about Y. And that really sustains me day-to-day through the ups and downs. You don't find anything. It doesn't pan out. You can't use that material. Still, there's another day. But we're speaking the day after the Booker weekend of a year invested in. It's kind of like being part of a run, a year-long run. Mm-hmm. What do I have to look forward to? And I have to look forward to two productions, one rehearsing in August, another next January, that I think about every day. And I can't talk about them yet. They haven't been announced, right. But I'll be involved in small way with one, probably both. And just the expectation of the knock on the door, the drug slipped underneath, the money passed through.
But that's more drugs.
It's going to carry me to August to January.
I mean, do you ever feel like 21st century plays, playwrights, are they in dialogue with Shakespeare? Do you feel like anything approaches that level of connection to you? Do they speak to you in the same way? My point is simply that it can be an obliterating pleasure too. And I'm also really talking about extremity in my own life. I mean, really, I've said this before on the podcast, but I've become a real junkie for those ceremonies in our human life that aren't quotidian, that are extreme, because they feel like they get somewhere close to that hit that I get from experiencing a great Shakespeare play.
In low dosages, I saw an Annie Baker play at the National this week.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
Man, she can write. Yeah, and the actors were understated and real. Mm-hmm. And when, I don't know his name, one actor comes on stage shirtless with five women sitting there, and he says, I don't want to be a dick about it, but it just captured the moment, his character, their relationship, and you realize somebody can write a line like that. And that is just great writing. That is at a Shakespearean level. Now, is it sustained through 100 minutes? No, but that was for a contemporary play for me. Right. And I'm just saying for me, and I'm sure my Shakespeare is somebody else's Annie Baker. So, but that having been said, there are some really talented playwrights out there. But we're all in debt to somebody who banged out close to 40 of the great ones.
Incredible. It's just ridiculous. All right, last question. Well, actually, this sounds a little bit like you've already told me what you still need from the theater. So what about this? What pisses you off about the theater?
The thing that most angers me is I could fly to London at 18 years of age, live in a church basement or a youth hostel for 50 pence a night, sit in the second row and there's an empty seat for another 50 pence, and spend $500 in a month seeing these plays. My students cannot do that.
Yeah, right.
They cannot. West End prices prohibitive. Mm. the whole structure of theater is now fractured because old people have sustained theater. When I saw the effect at the National a month or two ago, I was older by about three decades than anybody in my section.
You that and me. Was we were great. There on the same night.
Right. Of course. You brought your family.
That's right.
And it was electric.
It's great.
And theater is made for the young. And unless we figure out a way to ensure that young people can get hooked on theater, there is no future for theater. Mm. And it's not made for people sitting in the second row who know King Lear by heart, who wince when Derek Jacobi cuts a scene or a line. It's, you know, it's just, that's not what it's about. Mm. It's about young people seeing these plays for the first time, having those experiences collide with their own lives. That is really angering to me.
I don't know how you fix it. I mean, you work with young people all the time. You know what they want. You work with these extraordinary companies, the RSC here and Public in New York and many others. And it's this magic ingredient that seems to be missing, right? It becomes this. And also, you know, you've talked ad nauseam from my point of view, because I could read you and listen to you all the time. And I know you've been asked about it endlessly, about plague, pandemic, and how theatre bounces back from that. And you've always been very confident in your assertion that theatre bounces back stronger after a period of deprivation. I don't know if that's what we're seeing right now. And I wonder if that's because this 21st century technological revolution has pushed us all into little self-curated pods of isolation so that collective experience becomes something that we're less hungry for.
Well, I'll tell you what I've spent the last 3 years thinking and writing about, and Faber will bring out a book in early May on what I thought about. And I never quite made the connection between your last question and what I've been working on, and I'm happy now to have recognized it. Between 1935 and 1939 in the United States, under the New Deal of FDR, a federal theater was created to put on plays for next to nothing or nothing. And in the course of 4 years, they put on 1,000 productions seen by one out of every four Americans for almost nothing, and plays about everything from the danger of fascism to substandard housing. This is for a population that's not as literate as our own, is not as educated. And theater had the power to change a nation. So for me, it's not simply we're all in our little silos. It's we're all in our little silos watching the erosion of democracy. And theater and democracy were twin-born in ancient Greece for a reason. Mm. So there's a political side to this. We're joking about the drug side. There's a pleasure side to it. The two go hand in hand. And if you don't have a functioning theater, you don't have a functioning democracy.
God. And of course, what happened to that theater was that it ended up being investigated by McCarthy.
Well, the pre-McCarthy, there was the man who headed the first committee in the House on un-American activities was a man named Martin Dies.
Right.
He was a decade before McCarthy.
Oh, I see, yeah.
McCarthy learned everything from him.
Got it.
This was the playbook that was created to destroy theater and progressive culture. Right. So I call the book The Playbook because it's both about those play texts that were written and shared, but also about the playbook that was more successful than our playbooks.
God almighty. That is a fantastic warning, rallying cry. Thank you, Jim. So Biden, God willing, wins re-election and calls you up and he says, Jim, I need you to be my theater czar. And you're going to propose to him a new deal theater. You're going to make that speech about democracy and theater together.
I will. And then I'd appoint somebody 25 years old to run it, which is basically what they did back then.
Oh, very, very
good.
Get
somebody young, unexpected, hungry.
Jim, thank you so much for giving me the time, brilliant man.
As long as I get to see you on stage again soon, I'll be happy.
God, you talk to some of those directors. Thanks, man.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
All right, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen, the great Jim Shapiro. Really an extraordinary person, as I think we sort of touched on in our chat, an extraordinary person to have with you in the rehearsal room when you're trying to navigate the unfathomable heights and depths of these great Shakespeare plays. There really isn't much he doesn't understand or connect with. And as I said in our chat, his advice is not at all scholarly, or the help he gives rather than his advice, I mean. It's not at all of the head. He's, as you probably could tell from his conversation, his connection with Shakespeare is so much of the heart and of the gut. When I was playing Antony, in Antony Cleopatra for the RSC in the Public Theatre in New York, he was an incredible consultant on that, and when I did Coriolanus for Shakespeare in the Park for the Public Theatre. He was just invaluable. To have him on your side when you're doing something like that is to feel as close to Shakespeare as you can possibly get. Thank you so much, Jim, for giving me your time, particularly the night after the Booker, which must have taken it out of you in every possible sense. Listening to him talk about this stuff is just always an education and always a joy. He always manages to conjure how much it means to him. Thanks so much to Ben Backhouse, my producer, brilliant producer, and thank you to the musicians, Iggy and Phoebe Cake, thank you to the stage manager, thank you to you for listening. I really deeply, deeply appreciate your support. If you want to show more of it, if you go to the bit below where you click on your podcast, you'll find a rate, review, and subscribe. It's unbelievably helpful if you do all those things. I hope it won't take you too long. It really drives the jet engines of a little pod. Now, next week, have I got a treat for you. Next week, I interview live at the German Street Theatre, probably the greatest theatre director alive, and probably the greatest classical and jazz trumpeter alive. They just happen to be married to each other. What are the odds? 2 weeks ago, I interviewed Jez Butterworth and Laura Donnelly at the same address. They were described as the coolest power couple in British theatre. Well, I see you, one coolest power couple in British theatre, and I raise you one coolest power couple in British culture. Join me next week for Sam Mendes and Alison Wilson.
Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. Not a line right with Johnny, but here it is. Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony. Sees plays sad and funny. That's Stage Door Johnny. Stage Door Johnny. He knows that there's no money. Being Stage Door Johnny. Stage Door Johnny.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.